For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
We recently went through a 9-week practice commitment period where we do more intensive studying on a certain topic that's chosen before we do the period. The last period we did, we focused on bodhisattvas, which are enlightened beings that live in this human realm, sometimes take human form, sometimes they are human beings, but they've made a commitment to stay in this realm to help other living beings achieve enlightenment. So through the course, and there's all these different deities that have different personalities, and we're really looking at how their different personalities help them express the Dharma, or their different qualities, I should say. But through the course of that study, a couple of things were said that caught me, and so I wanted to focus on them for a Dharma talk, which really didn't have anything to do with the Bodhisattva idea. But one of them was Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma was the 28th patriarch of Buddhism, meaning in Asian practices, there are lineages, and a lineage is when a teaching is passed from one person to the next, to the next, to the next. Bodhidharma was considered the 28th teaching successor after Shakyamuni Buddha, and he lived around the 6th century CE, originally in India. He came to China to bring his flavor of Buddhism to China. So one of the stories that we were kind of talking about with him briefly was him turning away, having an engagement with somebody and turning away, and basically walking away. One of the other stories we looked at was a lay bodhisattva, meaning an average guy like you, me, and everybody else in this room, named Vimalakirti. And in one story, which I'll get to a little later, it's asked, how do you penetrate duality? So duality is our realm that we live in. There's good and bad, there's up and down, there's black and white. So that's duality. How do you penetrate that duality? And he's just totally silent. So a few people had expressed that this turning away and this silence made them a little bit uneasy. And I think it made some people uneasy because of the times we live in right now, which we know, you know, there's a Chinese axiom that's may you live in interesting times. And it's not meant to be a good luck charm. It really is meant, if you don't really like someone, you might say, may you live in interesting times, meaning that there's so much upset and turmoil in the country that things are very interesting, but things are also very unstable. So it isn't necessarily a good thing to live in interesting times. But I think we could all agree we live in very interesting times right now. And they tend to get more and more interesting every single week. So I wanted to talk about these two aspects of our practice, turning away and silence, and how they inform interesting times. Okay. So one thing, I wanted to start by saying that one thing we could all agree on that is that there's been an end to complacency in our society. Regardless of what your opinion is on anything that's going on, people are no longer feeling the need to be complacent. I do believe that people now feel that what they say or do is really going to matter in some faction or some aspect. So turning away and being silent, even though it seems contradictory to not being complacent, actually are the very heart of the things that inform our action, if we take a little closer look at them. We know in any given situation there's many ways to respond. In Buddhism, that's called skillful means. And we know as normal human beings that live out in the world, that's a nice phrase, but we often don't know what that really means. And we also know as adults that being skillful in how to respond takes on many different forms. There is no one right way for any given situation. And then even if there is one right way, one time, in the same type of situation, it doesn't mean it's going to apply again. Now, our Buddhist practice talks about this really from the get-go when Buddhism talks about impermanence and change, and meaning that we can't grab onto any single moment because we're always in a state of flux. So our teachings show us there's multiple ways of engaging with the world that we're living in, and that we actually need all those multiple ways, that we can't pick one over the other, depending on the situation and depending on what arises. But our practice also gives us the tools to explore every single one of those different responses, which is a wonderful thing. So skillful response lies in the very heart of our practice, which the very heart of our practice is the Zazen, which we all did today. So now I want to just get on to a little bit of the story. So this book is called The Intention of Patriarch Bodhidharma's Coming from the West. You know this book. Do you know this? Okay. This book was written by one of the first Chinese Zen masters. So in Chinese culture, Zen is called Chan. So one of the first Chinese Chan masters to come to the United States in the late 50s, early 60s, and he established a couple of monasteries out in California. His name was Xuan Hua. So he wrote this book, which is a series of all the different stories of Bodhidharma coming to China to bring his teachings to the Chinese. Now, we know a few of these stories. We talk about him coming and visiting the emperor of China at the time, which is Emperor Wu, and they have a little exchange. Taigen's actually going to talk about that next week. But most people who study Zen kind of know something about that. If you don't, it doesn't matter. It doesn't go well. So he goes away. Okay. Then what we know about him is at one point he ended up in a cave near a monastery in China, and he sat in meditation for 9 years. And this is really what he's known for. So there's really just him with himself facing the wall. So there's that relationship that we know about with him. We also know that his first student, in an act of devotion and commitment to the practice, in this very dramatic story, cuts off his left arm to prove his devotion to Bodhidharma so that he would accept him as a student. So that disciple was called Hui Ka. And that's kind of a story that's floating around out there. And most people who study any kind of Chinese Asian discipline will come across that story in some fashion at some point. But there are more stories about Bodhidharma's travels from India to China and when he got there and what happened. And what's great about it is basically it's an immigrant tale. Okay? And it's not glossed over. Like, if you really read any of these stories, it's stated that he went to China. He looked completely different than the Chinese. He had darker skin. He had longer hair. He had wider eyes. He couldn't speak the language. It's totally an immigrant tale. People were afraid of him, so if you read the stories, they were totally afraid of him. Children were running away from him. I mean, there were all these things going on. And basically, nobody was being very nice around him. So it's a lot of stories about people behaving very badly, which is so appropriate for our times right now. So anyway, I wanted to focus on a story of, originally, he came through in the south, in Guangzhou. Then he went to Nanjing and he visited the imperial court and he talked with the emperor. That didn't go well and he left. And so then he was kind of hanging around Nanjing. And the story says, okay, he didn't know any Chinese. But from his journey from Guangzhou to Nanjing, because he was a highly evolved person, he didn't really need to study the language like we would. He would learn a sentence of Chinese every day. So in 10 days, he would learn 10 sentences. In 100 days, he would learn 100 sentences. And the reason he learned all of that was because he knew how to listen. So again, I know like you could read the story and gloss over that, but this is actually a very important part to our practice, is that he was able to learn the language so quickly is because he truly knew how to listen. So that's something to think about too. But that's not the point of this story. So anyway, he's in Nanjing, and he hears about a great Dharma master named Shengguang, which means like all-abiding light. And this guy was on the top of his game. And again, it's a hierarchy in China, so he was well-respected, people venerated him. And it was believed whenever he taught a sutra being a Buddhist teaching, whenever he would teach anybody about sutras, the sky would open up, flowers would fall from the heavens, golden lotus blossoms would come up from the earth, maidens would dance, so all these magical things would happen because this guy had it going on as far as the Dharma went. Okay. So Bodhidharma heard about this, and he's like, well, I really want to hear this guy teach and kind of see what happens. So Bodhidharma comes, he's kind of in the back of the room, or the area, and you know, everybody knows he's a foreigner, so because this is part of the tale. So Shengguang sees him back there. He knows he's an Indian guy. There's already a little bit of gossip that he's kind of floating around Nanjing. And of course, Shengguang feels very proud of himself because he's like, oh my goodness, this guy from India, from India where Buddhism is from, who's supposed to be a great Dharma master, he's here listening to my talk. So he must know that I really understand the Dharma. So Shengguang gives a talk on a sutra. Again, sky opens up, the flowers come down, the lotus blossoms come up from the ground, there's maidens dancing, all these wonderful things happen. He's done teaching, he's feeling pretty good about himself because, boom, you know, again, entertainment value happened, right? So then he's kind of looking in the back to see if Bodhidharma will have anything to say. And Bodhidharma says to him, what are you doing? And he's a little taken aback. And he said, well, I'm teaching a sutra. And then Bodhidharma says, it's just ink and paper. So what is there to teach? And Shengguang goes, well, I mean, you're from India, right? So don't you know what teaching a sutra means? Don't you know what that is? And he's like, well, what do you do in India? I mean, do you not teach sutras in India? I'm a little confused. And Bodhidharma says, well, in India, our sutra is wordless. And so he asks Shengguang, so what about it? What do you think? What do you think about a wordless sutra? And Shengguang says, well, I mean, all I know is that I'm teaching about birth and death. That's what I'm doing. And Bodhidharma says, okay, so have you overcome birth and death? And of course, Shengguang didn't have an answer to that. But what happened is his temper rose. Because he was kind of put on the spot. He didn't know anything about a wordless Dharma. And he was in front of all these people. And he had some foreigner basically questioning his wisdom. So at that time, you know, everybody knows what Buddha beads are. They're either little bracelets or a necklace. Well, the masters would always wear a long necklace of Buddha beads. And because masters would travel from one place to another, oftentimes these Buddha beads were made of iron. So in his rage, he took off his Buddha beads and he whacked Bodhidharma. See, again, these stories always have a bit of violence in them. Whacked Bodhidharma across the mouth. Now what happened is it knocked out a couple of Bodhidharma's teeth. So as they get knocked out, Bodhidharma could feel, have any of you ever had your teeth knocked out? All right, if that happens, usually they're in your mouth, and you're like, oh, this is not a good thing, because you feel your teeth floating around in your mouth. But anyway, Bodhidharma feels his teeth floating around in his mouth. Now, in China, there's a story that if a holy person, because there's always a story or axiom in China, if a holy person spits out his teeth and they hit the ground, in that area where they hit the ground, it's not going to rain for 3 years. So Bodhidharma's like, okay, here's a dilemma. I have the teeth in my mouth. They've been knocked out. If I spit them out, all the people in this area are not going to get any rain for 3 years and they're not going to be able to eat. So I came to China to help save people. I didn't come to harm people, so I think I better just swallow my teeth. So he swallowed his teeth, he bowed to Shengguang, and he turned away. And he left. And then the story says he eventually walked to Henan, and that's when he stopped at Shaolin. Everyone thought he was nuts. He went up into a cave near the Shaolin Temple and sat there for 9 years. Because he realized this dialectic technique he was trying to use wasn't working. Just wasn't working. So I want to talk about what turning away means. Now, did he give up? No, he didn't give up. But he had enough insight to realize that he could talk and argue and use a dialectic method until he was blue in the face. But until someone is ready to listen, or until someone is ready to open their heart to what you're saying, no change is going to happen. No change of perspective is going to happen. So therein lies the lesson. He knew in that moment a couple of things. Not to respond to violence with violence. Not to continue on in this fashion when it would harm a lot of people around him. And maybe it was good to take a little break and find another way. Now, the Dharma he was teaching, when he says the Dharma can't be taught by words, this points back to Vimalakirti's silence, meaning it's beyond words. The minute we start talking, we create discriminations, categorizations, frameworks for our reality. And what he is saying is the true Dharma, our reality, is beyond that. It's beyond this dichotomy. It's beyond this dualism of up, down, black, white, left, right, him, her. When we sit in Zazen, that's where we need to sit so that the right response actually comes up. And if we're in a situation where we're finding the means we use in our normal world, like here, and the means could be a lot of things. It could be argument, it could be yelling, it could be writing letters, it could be marching, it could be hitting somebody. I'm not saying it's good, but you know, I want to talk about the world as it is, not as the world as we wish it is. It could be a lot of different responses. But if that response you've chosen at that time is not working, you have to have the wisdom to acknowledge that and find another way. He was supposed to be a manifestation of the Bodhisattva called Avalokiteshvara, or Kuan Yin, or Kanzan in Chinese and Japanese culture. That Bodhisattva normally manifests as a female, but that Bodhisattva can manifest as a male or a female. In our modern times, it's depicted more as a female. Originally, it manifested as a male. So it could be either or. But that Bodhisattva is the Bodhisattva of loving compassion, the Bodhisattva who hears the cries of the world. So even though Damu, or Bodhidharma, came to China and was pretty much taking people on, he still was the Bodhisattva who heard the cries of the world and was trying this means in order to respond to those cries. But the bottom line is, through all of that, when it doesn't work, we listen. We listen with all our heart. We listen without thinking about what we're going to say. And we listen without causing more harm. And again, I don't have the answers to all of that. But I just want to point out that we need to look at everything completely, especially when we're thinking of responding, because it is different times. And however you respond to whatever is going on, I do think we're trying to find a different way of being with each other. So people who do practice spiritual practices, it's an opportunity for us to look at our practices very closely and understand how to manifest them in this new world that we're coming into. Because we could all agree, it is a new world. It is changing. We just don't know where it's going. To close all of that out, I didn't, you know, in Vilma, I always have such hard times with these words, but anyway, Vimalakirti was a layman, and I can't really get to him and his silence, even though we touched upon it, but he was an everyday guy. And I just want to read one line about something Taigen wrote about him that was in the sutra about him, is that, where is it? Because it's so good. Hang on one second. It's in here somewhere. He had mastered the perfection of wisdom along with tolerance, eloquence. I like this one. Incantational powers, which means he was an awesome chanter and he could put mojos on stuff. You know, but he could change kind of what's going on by chanting something. And, you know, I just picture people all of a sudden changing and like, you know, there's a riot and he starts chanting and all of a sudden they're hugging each other like a SNL skit, you know. But anyway, he had powers for that. And also he was an expert in liberative techniques, meaning he was really good at meeting all kinds of different people and knowing exactly what needed to happen for that person to reach liberation or enlightenment, which I think that's, that, you know how intuitive someone like that really needed to be. And then he was able to express the teaching to all as appropriate, meaning that not everybody needs to hear the teaching because it's not appropriate at that time, especially if their ears and mind and heart is closed. Or especially if they're suffering so much that they need to be heard first. I want to close out with Shunryu Suzuki is the founder of our lineage. And he came to America in 1959, San Francisco, and he eventually established the San Francisco Zen Center. Unfortunately, he passed away too soon in 1971. But here is something that he said, and he's really talking about the silence of sesshin or longer meditation retreats. But I feel it's a bit appropriate to kind of the things we're looking at in this talk today. He said, to open your innate nature and to feel something from the bottom of your heart, it is necessary to remain silent. Through this kind of practice, you will have a more intuitive understanding of the teaching. Not to talk does not mean to be deaf and dumb, but to listen to your intuition. So again, basically in the talk, I just wanted to point to the importance of us at times being silent and turning away so that we could reconnect to our intuition through Zazen and figure out the right response. Okay, thank you. And if anyone has any questions or comments or anything about anything, feel free. Hi, Kathy.
That is thought provoking. What strikes me is that Bodhidharma had an incredible amount of self-control. Because I'm thinking of current day, it's kind of an encounter like that, and it's very hard not to flash out or tell somebody how they're thinking wrong, or at least want to do that, or to. So to step back and recognize this isn't going anywhere, this is not helpful, and to step away, I think that was kind of helpful on myself.
Yeah, it's amazing. His wall gazing changed the world. And no matter if you believe he did that or not did it or whatever, because historically no one really knows if he existed or not. There's not a lot written about him. He didn't write a lot of teachings himself. But something happened there in that cave. Something happened there because it influenced so many different Asian disciplines and it influenced the West. So when you think it, like, that's why I like to look at the stories, because it's mind-boggling to think about the effect this man had without, in a way, not doing that much. You know, he didn't even stay there that long either in China. He walked, he left, and there's stories about him after he left, you know, but not a lot.
Said this, but it really kind of stuck with me. The importance of not using silence as like a an endpoint or a technique, because silence is so ambiguous. You know, when someone is silent or when we're silent, others around them don't know why and can misinterpret it. And so. I liked the idea of using silence as one tool, you know, a tool that we can use ourselves to maybe gain some insight into how we could be more beneficial or more skillful. And sometimes, you know, a tool that we can use with others, but not the be-all and end-all, you know, which is how I think it can sound in the Sutra about the Vimalakirti. That was the answer. Silence is not the answer, but silence is one of the many tools that we can use in finding an appropriate response.
Yeah, that's one reason I wanted to bring that up, because it taken by itself, what does it mean? But if it's taken in the context of his life, he wasn't someone who just sat in the background and didn't say anything. Yeah. This guy was out in the world. Of all the bodhisattvas, he was out there. Just like we are, you know, and our practice is so much about engagement with other individuals, other life forms, not only human beings, but other life forms, and our planet, and maybe even out there in the cosmos soon. So.
We get people to open their hearts so that they will listen and we listen.
And that therein lies the challenge, I don't know.
We've been talking about using silence as a way of sort of creating a space where we can then perhaps find an appropriate response. And there's also a way in which it's taken me a really long time to learn this. I'm really slow on this. And that is that sometimes not responding is exactly what's needed, especially interpersonally, where especially in times of conflict. In a conversation with my wife, you know, if she says something that is, and we're in a little conflict, my instant response is to want to communicate through to a place of resolution or something, which is often what you need to do. But there are a lot of times when it's really just best for me to listen and hear it and not say anything. She's just saying something. Someone else, I think if they're just saying something, why do we always feel like we have to respond? Why do we always feel as if we have to maybe explain ourselves, make it nicer environment between us, or, take away the conflict, or resolve it, or correct them? And sometimes I just let it hang in the air, and it's amazing sometimes what I find, sometimes that's a use of it, that it's very beneficial for it to hang in the air.
You bring up a good point, and I forgot to talk about this because it's the main thing I have to work on in my life. I mean, like, number one, patience. Because in that silence, we also have to practice patience. And see, I just blew right over it.
Strongly recommend it. I thought it was going to be, I'm an admirer, so I thought it was going to be about his life. But it is profound, and it moved all, you know, my brother and his wife, and it's like, it was incredibly moving, and he had something in terms of response. You know, for example, at a time when TV was coming out, and they were putting out crappy TV, TV for kids, you know, like with kids banging other kids or pouring paints on heads or, you know, just like useless. He said, what do children need? This is a fantastic tool. And he went about not criticizing the shows, but simply developing. Like, he had never done TV before. He just realized it was a need. He liked children. He was interested in child development. And he went into it. And then it shows much more about his life and how he ran the production so that we learn a lot more about him. But sometimes for people to move deeply into what is useful, meaningful, sometimes can be an illustration to other people. And I'm not trying to say that's the only thing. It was just an example of, you know, somebody who had a profound effect simply by sticking with, he was a very good listener, and he focused that on children. The theme of, you know, it's okay to feel good about yourself, it's okay to own your own feelings, it's okay, we can sit with whatever is happening, and a personal connection. Anyway, so I just thought I'd share that. In terms of, there's different ways to respond, it's the same as something that,
and we don't really know, because you can't quantify the effect he had on society, but how many generations of children, young people, did he influence with his gentle way and his good listening? But you can't quantify the change that he brought up on in the world, but he had faith in what he was doing, that it was the right response. You know, I know I've heard only good things about it. I can't wait to see it.
And we still have to listen in the silence. Is this working? Or should I be saying something? I think there's a trial and error in every moment. And to your point, silence is one tool. But action is also another tool. So this trust in saying you, if we just say that, like trying to think of the perfect response, then nothing will happen. So I kind of really, that's stuck in my mind, this system. Because every situation is different, and you've got to try something. And sometimes
and things work out.
Or not, but then you try again. Thank you. That was really good.
Thank you. Well, as a fun fact to this story, Shengguang ended up becoming Hui Ke. Because through another story, he realized how terrible, he made a big mistake, that this was the enlightened master that was promised to China. And he ended up sitting out in the snow and making a great sacrifice so that he would finally accept him. And then his name became Hui Ke. So that's I didn't know that either until I found this book. So that was kind of interesting too. So there's a lot of ups and downs through this whole journey.